seagull. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk Episode 450 to be broadcast on Wednesday, August 6th, 2025 on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. We're planning on doing this together today, but I ran into a muscle spasm in my neck, and that's another story. So I am now doing it a little bit later. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show and you're listening right here on Facebook Live, you can comment down here below. I might be able to get back to you. You could also send me an email at bicycletalk, the numeral one, at gmail.com. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. I'm having a hard time getting my words out today. Another bump of the road, episode 4. Well, the pain is still here, but the management is improving and I'm getting better. Much better at this, much better than the last week. Yeah, so that's a good thing. As you can see, I am collarless. We'll talk about that in a bit. We'll get back to that. The Governor's Highway Safety Association is a nonprofit association representing highway safety offices of states, territories, and the District of Columbia in Puerto Rico. Yeah, why did I mention that? Because drivers struck and killed 7,148 people in the United States last year. That's enough to fill 31 Boeing 737s, according to a new report from the GHSA. One in four are hit and runs. Yeah, I got to bring stuff like this up because this is just very, very alarming. It really upsets me when I read these things. We know that that's just pedestrians. We know there's cyclists involved here too, but, you know, here we are. Anyway, I don't know what else to say. I'll talk about it a little bit more in the show. And I warned you, didn't I warn you? The tariffs are on. Adjusted tariffs affecting bike-producing countries, including Taiwan, 20%, Vietnam, 20%, Cambodia, 19%, and Malaysia, 19%. A senior Trump administration official said 26 of the deficit countries will face tariffs higher than the new 15% minimum. Yeah, how about that, huh? Boy, oh boy. And that White House describes that as excessive trade imbalances. Why is this doing this? Here we go. Sorry. Computer issues. It's just crazy. So, on a positive side, San Diego has reduced speed for 11 high crash areas. San Diego implements reduced speed limits in 11 corridors this week, dropping speeds by 5 miles per hour in pedestrian heavy areas, including Hillcrest and Ocean Beach. We'll talk more about that in the show. You know how I talk about it's the speed that kills, folks? Because it's the speed that kills. It really is. We are not safe on the roads as long as we keep letting people speed. It's just annoying. But there's a positive side to it because cities like San Diego are taking they're taking action on it. So that's really cool. Check it out. The collar is off. Yeah. I've been broadcasting my last, what was it, three episodes with a cervical collar on because of all the work that I had done on my neck. I don't have a titanium bike, but I've got 16 titanium screws and 2 titanium rods holding my neck back together. No, it wasn't a crash. It was just mom. Yeah. I've talked about this on the show for the last few weeks now that I've been able to actually sit in front of a computer and record again, which is not the easiest thing that I do. It's definitely a little bit tough on the neck and a little bit tough on my patience, but I'm here. Yeah, no more collar. It's been 6 weeks as of the just tomorrow at broadcasting this. I'm recording this on Monday, and tomorrow I will be 6 weeks out, and Wednesday you will be hearing the show. So on WHUS. Now, the Tour de Femme is over, but what an action-packed, entertaining race. I got to tell you, I think that the development of women's racing over the last few years, watching last year's the Olympics, watching the Paris-Roubaix, watching some of these incredible races, we have gone from this level right here to this level right here. If you're listening to this on audio, I raised my hand up over my head from my chest. So, yeah, big changes in the women's racing scene. Lots of attacks. Lots of very, very technical, well-executed racing moves going on. The teams were great. The teams were essential for this. It was just an impressive, impressive display. I have to say, I had fun watching it every single day, and I generally have, over the years, not been as impressed with the women's racing scene. It changed, overnight, I'm going to say. It's been just spectacular to watch them. If you get a chance to watch any of the highlights on YouTube, definitely worth watching. There's some great stuff going on. And, that's it. Vive la France, by the way. Why did I say Vive la France? We'll talk about that later in the show. And before you know it, we're going to be watching the Vuelta. Yeah. Mechanical Minute and Ron's Tips of the Week. Is there an ideal cadence for cycling? Well, that is a darn good question. I'm a big cadence fan. And cadence, of course, is how fast your pedals are going around, typically measured in revolutions per minute, RPM. A cyclist's power output is the product of force and cadence. Power equals force times velocity. Therefore, we can increase power output by pushing harder on the pedals, increase force, increase cadence, or both. Interesting thing, if you ever get a chance to sit on a bike, I'll call it an indoor bike at a local gym if you can do it, or maybe on your trainer at home and you have a power meter on, check what happens when you add 10 RPMs onto your normal cadence. You can watch the power go up. So you do get power from it. And that's what everybody says. They go, well, I'm more of a masher. I push my pedals hard and that's how I get all this power. Not necessarily so. And the problem is that you're going to run into the point of no return, which is you can only mash for so long before you're before your legs can't keep up with it anymore, before your actual muscles will fatigue to a point where they can no longer push hard and mash. The ideal thing to do is to build up your cadence so that you can then work on your cardiovascular system. Your cardiovascular system is going to recover much sooner than the power system in the muscles in your legs. So is there an ideal cadence for cycling? By the way, the information that I am giving you comes from CTS, Carmichael Training Systems, and he's got a great training and coaching site that you can check out if you want to learn more about that. You can go to trainright.com, I think is what I have here. So anyway, cycling cadence. Let's talk a little bit more about it. What is a good cadence? A mountain of research generally concluded that most cyclists naturally gravitate to cadences between 80 to 100 RPMs. I tell people this all the time. They say, well, how fast should I be spinning? And I say, well, 80 to 100 RPMs, everyone's going to be a little different. Everyone's going to find a natural place to fall into. But if you are below 80, you are pedaling very inefficiently. So you really need to focus on trying to work on that. That's where I throw in the whole indoor cycling thing and winter training. If you're not on the road, you can use it. You can use the trainer or the rollers or the indoor spin bike or whatever to develop and work on your cadence, because cadence is essential. It really works. Preferred or self-selected cadence tends to increase gradually with experience and fitness. Specific cadence-focused training can lead to increased or decreased in self-selected cadence, depending on your training parameters. Okay, so we will see more about that. Beginners often pedal slower, between 65 and 85 RPMs at endurance, intensity, and uphills. An underdeveloped aerobic system and lower mechanical efficiency for pedaling may be contributing factors to increased reliance on force production. Experienced cyclists typically pedal between 75 and 95 RPMs during sustained efforts at recovery, aerobic endurance zone 2, and lactate threshold FTP intensities. This includes riding on flat terrain, rolling hills, and prolonged climbs. High cadences, 95 to 110 RPMs, are usually reserved for high intensity, high power efforts and accelerations. Did you hear that? High power efforts. In training, that includes VO2 max and anaerobic capacity intervals and sprint workouts. Low power, high cadence drills can be utilized for neuromuscular training, improving mechanical efficiency. Cycling economy versus mechanical efficiency. A common but oversimplified belief that in cycling is that the higher cadence is better for performance. Some of this comes from the fact that highly trained cyclists and elite competitors typically maintain higher cadences than beginners and amateurs. Cycling economy refers to the oxygen cost of producing a given power output. Mechanical efficiency refers to how much mechanical work results relative to the energy produced. In practical terms, we evaluate the process or the progress by looking at oxygen cost at a given power output. When you can lower the oxygen cost to produce 200 watts of power, you have improved cycling economy. There's a fine line here, and you got to play around with it until you get it right. Everybody is going to be different. I tell people this all the time. There is no ideal number here, but if you can work on the cadence, you can really get a lot better feel for it. Your body will appreciate it a little bit more because you're going to be putting less strain on your joints. And you're also, you're going to increase the amount, your ability to process oxygen, which is really, really good. So lower cadence cycling can be more economical metabolically, but because there are less frequent muscle contractions. Fewer, more forceful contractions also recruit more fast twitch muscle fibers. These fibers produce energy anaerobically, but also fatigue quickly. Got that? Yeah, there it is. So the higher cadence cycling can be more costly in terms of oxygen consumption because muscles must contract and more frequently. Lower force production per pedal stroke also shifts the muscle fiber recruitment to favor aerobic, more fatigue-resistant, slow-twitch fibers. Whether you break down the fuel usage, fuel to usable energy, or more or less economically, only about 20 to 25% of that energy ends up performing mechanical work. The other 75 to 80% is lost as heat. Interesting. So there are benefits of training at different cadences. You can improve your cycling economy and your mechanical efficiency. On the metabolic side, muscles take on oxygen and fuel, Endurance training improves your ability to break down fuel into usable and energy and increases your body infrastructure utilizing the energy for mechanical work. As cyclists become more economical, they produce the same power at lower oxygen. And that's really interesting because you're observing that by through a lower heart rate, basically. With practice and proper bike fit, that's to optimize your biomechanics, cyclists can also improve the mechanical efficiency of their pedal strokes. Some of this comes down to joint angles, leverage, and tendon stiffness. Training, including cadence drills, simulate stimulate neuromuscular adaptations and improve the synchronization of muscle contractions for less wasted energy. The goal of cadence training is not to home in on the athlete's one ideal cadence. The goal is to increase the range of cadence that a cyclist can use effectively to produce power. The best cyclists have good cadence agility, meaning that they can rapidly transition from high force, low cadence, to lower force, high cadence as circumstances demand. Right, because you're still going to have to use that power somewhere. And it could be that you're riding your bike down the road and you're feeling like you've got a little, I like to call them poppers, is what I call them, a slight popper ahead. So that might be maybe an 8 to 10% climb that's very short. You can see the top of it, but you need to jam on it to get over. And so you might need to use possibly a little lower cadence to do that and then power through. Or people that are experienced will just keep the cadence high, shift with it, and stay at that higher cadence and power over that way. There's a number of ways you can do this. When you want to use high cadence in cycling, the times to leverage high cadence include sprints, attacks, accelerations, and prolonged high efforts like time trials and solo breakaways. So as I said, you got that little bump in the road you're trying to get over, you use your high cadence, you power through it, and over you go. Some people prefer to get out of the saddle and muscle over it. I have a combination of both when I ride. I've always been a higher cadence rider, so it effectively works better for me to use the cadence to get me over because I just don't have the muscular endurance and strength to be able to maintain a lower cadence with a lot of muscle. My legs will just run out of gas, basically. So that's when you want to use your high cadence. And when do you want to use your low cadence? Low cadence is useful in training muscular endurance. Okay, that's just mentioned muscular endurance earlier, producing a high torque and accelerating from a stop or slow speed. It can also be used to conserve energy and maintain momentum while drafting or riding in a pack. So if you're in a situation where you have a little tailwind and or you're sitting in with a couple of friends when you're out riding and they're breaking the wind in front of you, yeah, you can drop it down into a little bigger gear and just kind of sit back there, let your heart rate come back down, and because you're not really putting a ton of effort into that. Cadence, it can be used for triathlon and different cycling disciplines. So high peak average cadence are more important for road and criterium racers, BMX competitors, and track racers. But it's not just the ability to turn the pedals over quickly. Overall, producing higher power at high cadence is the essential combination for winning performances. Not everybody wants to be a bike racer. Not only everybody has to be a bike racer. If you're listening to the show, you probably aren't a bike racer. You're probably just, the guy who or gal who's just out riding their bikes on the weekend, maybe doing the long ride, maybe doing a few short rides through the week to keep your fitness up. You know, that's most of us. That's really most of us that are out there. There's a very small percentage that are high-level athletes on our bikes. There's a very large pile of us that think we're high-level athletes on our bikes, but actually aren't at all. But that's what it is. It's all about cadence. And you can do cadence drills. You can start with 3 to 5 one-minute efforts separated by 2 minutes of moderate cadence recovery. You can progress to a three-minute effort with 5 minutes recovery between them. Your heart rate will increase, but your RPE should stay at about 5 to 10. So there's an essential piece to this, really, really important. That is, if you are doing these drills, if you are really paying attention to them, you're paying attention to your cadence, recovery is key. You got to let your legs come back. You got to let your breathing come back before you attack another one. And if you do that and you do it very, very consistently, then you will get stronger and better on your bike. Your heart rate may increase, but that's okay. That's okay. This happens. That's why they call it a workout. Okay. I generally teach high intensity interval training in my spin classes because Well, otherwise, sitting on a spin bike is just basically boring. I do not, and I am guilty of this, but it's hard because you want to keep the attention of the class you're working with, and not everybody wants to be trained, so to speak, on their bike. So we do not take as long a rest intervals as I prefer to take. That's why when I'm teaching a class, I am oftentimes not participating in what I am teaching. But my class members tend to like that high intensity stuff, and they just want to get in and get an hour in and get the work done. And that's fine. I get it. That's just fine. You can do high speed sprints either standing or seated. To be sure, seated accelerations are important if you're in a race or in a group ride. Standing up and swinging your bike around is a dead giveaway you're attacking. If you can powerfully rev up your cadence while you're keeping your upper body calm, you may ride people off your wheel before they realize what's going on. Low cadence cycling drills, the last piece here, and then I will stop. So low cadence cycling drills are overgeared climbing, often overlooked component of building climbing speed. During muscle tension intervals, you are pedaling slowly, about 50 to 55 RPM cadence against very heavy resistance in order to recruit and engage more muscle fibers and generate the necessary force to continue climbing. These are aerobic intervals in your power output will be at or below your functional threshold power, FTP, which is, you know, just below 80% of your max. To clarify, these are high force efforts, not necessarily high peak power efforts. Prolonged high force intervals at aerobic cardiovascular intensity may also lead a subset of fast twitch type 2 muscle fibers to change their characteristics and be more like endurance-friendly slow twitch fibers. To perform them well, you need to climb that last at least 5 to 10 minutes. The grade doesn't have to be steep, although it can be steady. 1 to 2% falls flat will work, and that's all you have, if that's all you have. Total time intensity at intensity for a single workout should be around 20 minutes for beginners, 30 minutes for intermediate riders, and 40 for advanced riders. Doesn't have to be exact, but that's a, you know, it's just a starting point. You can divide that total time intensity in a variety of ways: 3 by 7 minutes, 4 by 5 minutes, 2 by 15 minutes, or 3 by 12 minutes. A good starting point for beginning and intermediate riders would be 4 times 5 minute intervals. Recovery between intervals should be equal to the duration of the efforts. Did I tell you about rest? Yeah. So, you know, if you're going to go hard for 5 minutes, you need a 5 minute break. It's not rocket science, folks. It's science. So anyway, if you're looking to improve your riding on your bike, we're at that time of year where a lot of people have been on their bikes for months now, and they're starting to really feel some good fitness. Might be a time to, we're going to be hitting a time of the year where you're going to start backing off due to weather and daylight concerns. And it's a good time to, you know, just pay a little closer attention to what's going on. This is why I like cyclocross so much, because the cyclocross race is simply a 40 to 50 minute race, and that's, you know, and you're going all out, you're doing that high intensity work, but and you're also getting some great skills in this at the same time, but it really is good for you and your development as a rider. So as you start gearing down, you might want to take on a cross race or two. It's great races coming up. We got a whole series here in Connecticut, 7 races in the series. I just looked at the schedule. I'm number 5 in the series, which is usually I'm fairly early in the series, but yeah, I've got 4 in front of me. So there we go. Anyway, that's enough of that. We are going to zap out of this site. A shout out to Chris Carmichael for sharing that information online, because it's been really, really useful for folks like myself to learn a little bit more about what I'm doing as far as helping people with their training and their fitness levels. So anyway, content. Let's get in here. We're going to go on into advocacy, and I'm going to talk about that Governor Highway Safety Commission, the GHSA. It's a nonprofit organization which, you know, covers all of the United States plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. So I mentioned that one in four of the 7,148 people in the United States last year were hit and runs. That's a lot of people. And also there were enough to fill 31 Boeing 737s. Ouch, that's just horrible. So that is definitely a problem. And this is, let's see here, pedestrian deaths. Make sure I get the right one here. This is really kind of sad when you think about it. Year over year, pedestrian deaths are actually down 4.3%, the second consecutive annual decline. However, pedestrian fatalities remain nearly 20% above the 2016 level, 40-year high in 2022. So what's going on, folks? What's going on? The cars are becoming more deadly. The cars are much bigger. The cars are being guided by telephones. Remember telephone? Cell phones. Sorry about that. I showed my age. The cell phone distraction is just grotesque, what's going on here. And I really believe that that has a lot to do with it. But I will also note that the other thing that has a lot to do with this is that the speeds are increasing. If you are not driving around in a new vehicle these days or haven't had the experience of doing that, it's a lot quieter in there than it used to be. It's incredible the difference as far as that goes. Almost every single vehicle on the road now has some sort of a heat pump or air conditioning system in the car. So therefore, people tend to roll the windows up, making it even quieter. And, you know, quiet is not necessarily good because you can find yourself, as you're driving down the road, you can find yourself at a much higher speed than you had planned to be at and be very surprised when you see the lights come on behind you because you're speeding. So to help address the pedestrian safety crisis, the GHSA supports a holistic solution that establishes a multi-layered safety net that can protect everyone on the road. A key part of the safety net is traffic enforcement focused on dangerous driving behaviors like speeding, impaired and distracted driving that put people on foot in danger across the country. This also puts people on bicycles in danger. So there's a lot of people looking at this very, very carefully. And I will bring on my next little piece here as we talk about this. And we will we'll talk, actually, where's my, here is it, San Diego, California. Reduces speed for 11 high crash areas. I found this to be rather interesting. City crews are installing new speed limit signs this week as San Diego implements reduced speed limits in 11 corridors with high pedestrian traffic and crash rates. Changes are made possible by state legislation passed in 2022 that will slow down traffic by at least 5 miles per hour in areas spanning 3 council districts. I'm not going to get into exactly what those districts are because I'm not from San Diego and maybe I only have one or two people that are listening that are from San Diego, but not a big deal. What the big deal is, it got passed in 2022. It is now, hello, 2025, and it's just now being implemented. Now, what am I going to say about that? Get loud. Show up to a town meeting, voice your concerns, complain about the fact that people are going super fast on your road if you need to. I'm about to put some signs up on a big old tree at the end of my driveway because I'm just sick of it. They just repaved my road. My road just went from bumpy back road to expressway freeway. The speed limit is 30 miles per hour. The average speed on the road, I can safely guess to be somewhere between 45 and 50 miles per hour because my road is used as a shortcut to get from one large state road to another large state road. So we see a lot of that kind of activity. Roger, you're right. No rack. I lost my jewelry. Nice, huh? Isn't it great? So, thank you for listening, by the way. So Assembly Bill 43, which took effect in 2022, gives cities more flexibility to lower speeds based on safety considerations rather than solely relying on how fast most drivers travel. Previous cities are required to raise speed limits if the majority of drivers exceeded existing limits, even in unsafe areas. That's a dumb idea. Anyway, we won't even get into that. After conducting traffic studies in 38 areas, the city identified corridors across San Diego that qualified at business activity districts, safety corridors under the new law. And that's according to Maggie McCormick, Transportation Deputy Director. Studies have shown that severe injury and fatal crashes are less likely to occur at lower speeds. It's spelled D-U-H. Duh. Yeah. This is something, I mean, I talk about this almost every week, maybe to a point where it's a little nauseating, but we got to slow everyone down. That's why the new ideas that are being implemented with traffic safety and traffic design is to make roads a little more calm than they used to be, which means putting in center barriers that give the vision of the road being narrower than it really is, putting in traffic circles or roundabouts, which greatly reduces the speed of cars and also increases the volume of vehicles that can go through. It also drops down that vehicle to the level of the cyclist, which is what we want. We want you to understand that we are vehicles too. So anyway, lower speeds, they're absolutely critical. The speed reductions, they've got even a couple of them here. They drop from 30 miles per hour down to 25 miles per hour, and even some 25 mile per hour zones down to 20 miles per hour. You know what I've said? If I were king, every crosswalk would be 20 miles per hour because it's the right thing to do. You shouldn't be speeding through a crosswalk. Fran and I were up at the farmer's market on Saturday, up in Stores, and there are multiple crosswalks up there because it's right across from the university, it's right across from the high school, it's where the town hall is. And I stood there and watched. I didn't stand there. I was driving to one of those crosswalks. I stopped for the crosswalk and I watched not one, not two, not three, but four cars from the other direction not stop when there were people standing in the crosswalk. We need an education program here, folks. That should be a $100 fine. Boom, that's it. That solves the problem very quickly. People are very attached to their finances, and getting hit with a $100 fine because you didn't stop for a pedestrian of crosswalk sounds good to me. I like that idea. Anyway, what can I say? I can, if I were king, you know, but I'm not, and we don't like kings. Kings are not a great idea. You know, we're not real big about that. So anyway, it's just a fantastic idea. It really is. Slow everyone down. And when you see a crosswalk, it's an immediate red flag that you need to come down to a reasonable speed. And if you won't come down to a reasonable speed and you're driving a motorized vehicle, then I'm going to start getting on my high horse and talk about speed tables and putting speed tables at every single crosswalk. Because if you think about the idea of what a speed table is, and if you don't know what it is, I'll explain it right now. What it is, it's the speed bump. So it goes up and then it flattens across the width of a crosswalk, maybe 6 feet, and then goes down on the other side. And I'm going to tell you something. You hit a speed table at over 25 miles an hour or even 20 miles an hour, and you're going to hit hard on the bottom of your motorized vehicle. It will do damage. So speed tables are the answer. They give a flat, safe area for people to walk across, which would be a really good idea. And, you know, it's just a little extra tar and some paint. It's not that hard. And you already have a crosswalk there anyway. Let's bring them down to reality and bring them down to the speed that makes more sense. So, anyway, heads up, tip of the cycling cap, or as they say over in England, chapeau, to San Diego for paying attention and making a big difference here. Let's hope a lot of other cities start paying attention to this, because it's a concern. It's a really big, big concern. So we got that. Let's go on to, I got to go here. Let's go to the Tour de Femme. Okay, Tour de France is over. We saw a great Tour de France. I got some things I'd like to talk about on that, maybe a little later if I have some time, but I'm much more interested right now in talking about the Tour de Femme. It is unbelievable what that race was all about this year. I just thought it was really cool. The French are back in the limelight. Vive la France, okay? The last four stages of the Tour de Femme, all right? The last four, the first of those two of the four were won by a 23-year-old French rider who is my new, she's my new, I love this woman. I love the way she rides. I love her personality on the bike. Her name is Maeve Squibbins. And she broke away on stage six. Yeah, stage six. Broke away on a strong climb. Left everybody behind. She's not much to her. She's a great climber. And off she went. She didn't finish high in the statistics at the end of the race at all. But she had her day. And she went out and she launched it. And no one caught her. She did a solo attack towards the end. It was on a large mountain, hill, whatever you want to call it. And off she went. And she was as shocked as everybody else was. This girl has got it. She's got the gusto. She's got the intelligence. She can corner well on the downhills. She was cornering at, what did they say she was cornering at? Something like 60 kilometers per hour, which is like 50 miles an hour. It's really fast. And she was cutting great lines. I just loved watching her. She was just a blast to watch. And so anyway, she wins stage six, goes out the next day, stage seven, does it again. Yeah, two in a row, back-to-back wins. She's from France. The French were ecstatic. They had a French woman who was out there, and she was putting on a spectacular show. And the French are very into their cycling. And you know what? They haven't seen the French men are not performing as well as the women are right now. And right now, you know, the Dutch women are like kicking butt in women's pro cycling, but the French women had their day. Stage six, stage seven, now comes stage eight. Okay, let's go to stage eight and talk about that a little bit. So this is just so much fun. It was just a blast to watch. Let's see, get my screen up here. Now comes Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, okay, another French woman. Not just any French woman, okay, she comes from a cycling background. Her uncle, I believe, was a mountain bike racer, pro mountain bike racer. She got into mountain bike. She won the Olympic. Let's make sure I get this right here. I got my stats right here. She has been an elite national, world, and Olympic champion across various disciplines in which she competes. She was the youngest competitor in the women's road race in the 2012 Summer Olympics, in which she finished eighth. 12 years later, at the 2024 Summer Olympics, she won the gold medal in cross-country mountain biking event. And the following year, she won, yes, stage eight in the Tour de France. And she, the Tour de France Femmes, she launched hard on a climb and just people couldn't stay with her. She rides for the Visma team. They worked really well with her and kept her out there, and off she went, and she ended up winning stage 8. Now she's coming into stage 9, and everybody's pretty upset because, you know, she's got a pretty sizable lead. So there were a lot of attacks, and I mean miserably hard attacks, and all of a sudden the Visma team found themselves quite a ways behind chasing down the peloton. It was two pelotons, basically, and a breakaway up the road. And the back peloton had all the Visma riders in it. And that's not good news, although it is good news if you've got all your teammates there to get up in the front and really pull and take the pace on. And eventually they caught on. She gets to the point where they're getting near the end of the race, and she she launches another attack on the hills, and off she goes. And my God, what a great, great thing she did. She launched this attack. She put an amazing amount of distance on her competitors, and France was on fire, because this is the first time that a French person has crossed the line in the Tour de France since Bernard Hinault. Now, there was a woman that was maybe 2 years later. I think there was a French woman who might have been, I'm looking to see if it's on this, but I don't see it on here. Jeannie Longo, and she became the world race champion in Spain many, many, many years ago. But that was 19 years ago. 19 years ago. So all of a sudden the French are, you know, they're out there, they're doing their thing. They race fairly well in cross. They race really well in mountain biking. Oh, did I mention that Ferran Prevot also won the women's Paris-Roubaix this year? This woman's on fire, and she is so much fun to watch. She's another one of those heavy, puts her head into it, competitors, all emotions at the end. Just incredible. So anyway, this year's Tour de France was a whole bunch of fun. The Femme was a whole bunch of fun to watch. It was just a great, great time. It was the fourth year now that they've had the Tour de France Femme avec Zwift, and it's been, it was just a really, really wonderful race to watch. Yeah, here it is. French winner of the Tour de France, the first French win at the Tour de France since Bernard Hinault in the 1985 Tour de France and Jeannie Longo in the 1989 Tour de France Féminine. Now that came and went, and now it's come back, and now they've got a definite strong following, and it looks like good finances behind it now too. In the race's other classifications, Lorena Wiebes, who she won the green jersey and the points classification. Elisa Chabé took the polka dot jersey as the winner of the Queen of the Mountains, and Nike Vinke of team I'm not gonna pronounce the name of the team, took the white jersey as the best of the winner of the young riders. She is 21 years old. It was just a fun thing. And Maeve Squibben, yeah, I talked about Maeve Squibben earlier, took the combative award because of her wins on stage 6 and 7. It was just a fun race to watch. So if you didn't get a chance to watch it, I'm going to tell you that you can go to YouTube and you will find episodes of short clips, maybe wrap-ups that you will find on there, and you'll be able to see some of the highlights in those wrap-ups. Definitely worth watching, no question about that. So again, Maeve Squibben was just stunning. She was absolutely stunning, and she's just a blast to watch. I am very, very impressed with her, and I think we're going to see a lot more coming out of France real soon. I really do. So hang in there, folks. We got a lot more to talk about here today also. And where are we at here? Okay, we still got another 15 minutes to go here, so we're going to chit chat about a few other things. Let's start out with the UCI has added again pro cyclist gear restrictions are set to be tested in 2025 as UCI confirms test event. Okay, here we go. So the UCI is very concerned about the number of crashes. And the conclusion, and if you don't watch bike racing as much as I do, you may not know much about this, but God, there's a lot of crashes. It seems like there's more crashes than there have ever been in the past. And I know it's part of the sport. I know it happens. And if you're a NASCAR fan, that's why you go to NASCAR events, to see the crashes. So if you're into that, maybe you should pick up bike racing. Not really. It's really nasty when they go down. People get real hurt and it's not great. But anyway, rider mistakes and upcoming points of interest are the most common causes of crashes, according to Safety R. And cycling's cross-party safety body, which is called Safety R, is given mid-year update in their mission to make racing less dangerous, sharing the results of the crash analysis work, confirming the event for upcoming maximum gear ratio testing, and a body made of representatives from cycling's key stakeholders, teams, race organizers, ride unions, and the UCI work with the UCI and other stakeholders to improve safety in cycling. Their work informed much of the swath of new safety measures introduced by the UCI, including new equipment rules and introduction of maximum gear ratio tests. There's still people complaining about it. And Visma's Richard Plouge he's ashamed to have crashes in his race if he was an organizer. That's what he said. There's still a lot going on here. But the conclusion is riders' own mistakes were the most common cause of crashes, says the safety body. As UCI confirms, rider tracking will be introduced at the 2025 Road World Championships. Let's see if it comes up with anything. I am going to mention a number of things here. The implementing these windy, nasty, twisty, turny finishes on a sprint stage is just really a bad idea. Really, really a bad idea. You put a lot of those 90-degree turns into sprint stages, people are going to crash. They're winding up for the big sprint. The peloton is breaking into these groups that are going to power the train through to get their sprinter to the front, and it just creates chaos when they put all the twists and turns in. My opinion for sure. The other safety concern I have for these races is maybe even a little bit longer distance between the finish line and winding into that final sprint, so that it's possible that riders can have a little bit more room to be safe and not have to take so many risks and chances when they're riding. I don't like that at all. I don't like the way the barrier's set up, because if you get too close to a barrier because of the angle of the bottom barrier, you could clip a pedal on that, and that is just a tragedy when you do. It'll take you off your bike so fast you didn't even know what happened. So I'm a little concerned about that and how that should be maybe restricted. There should be nothing on the course when you're riding into the final sprints of these races, or even into the final finish lines, even on the long road races. There should be nothing on the course. And if you take a look at the barriers, you're going to see they're there. There's also a lot of issues with the mountaintop climbs and when and where they decide to finally barrier the fans away from, or the tifosi away from the crowd, away from the race. They're right on top of them. And I know it's a great sensation to have a fan screaming in your ear when you really need that extra enthusiasm, but you can hear them when they're 3 or 4 feet away. You don't have to have them touching you when you're going up the climbs. I even see Pogaccia gets real annoyed. He likes whacks at people when they touch him. He hates being touched. And I don't blame him. I don't blame him, because any little slight movement of that person can screw this rider for a long time. Could take him off his bike, could break his collarbone, could break another bone. You never know. And then, of course, we saw the infamous purse incident, where a guy was standing on the side of the climb, and he had a purse on, That's, by the way, that's a European thing. Don't get weird on me, okay? It's a European thing. Guy's purse strap got caught around, I think it might have even been Lance Armstrong's hood on the handlebar, on the brake hood. And down he went down real hard. Now, fortunately, there's that gentleman's rule, and they waited for him to get back on his bike and catch back up. We could talk about that another time. But anyway, there's definitely dangers involved with bike racing. I won't even get into the downhills. And the downhills, it's open game, man. It's open game. There's plenty of room on the downhills to go fast. They generally, you do not see a lot of fans on the downhills. If they are there, they're well off the road because they understand that, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 kilometers per hour is really, really fast. And someone is going to get hurt if they go down at that speed. So anyway, I tend to side with the riders on this. I'm not a big fan of the way the safety is laid out by the UCI. And we'll see more after the Worlds, I guess, and see what they conclude. The next thing that there is an update is that riders are required to have a maximum gearing of a 54-11. That's a really big gear, by the way, if you don't know that. That is a very, very big gear. But that's how you get, that's how you get 80 kilometers per hour going down a hill. Is if you got a 54-11, you can really roll that sucker out and you can go pretty fast. The other thing that they are working on, and this is the one that really ticks me off, and I only say this because I've been talking a lot about women's racing here due to the Tour de Femme, and the UCI is doubling down on handlebar width limits and maximum gearing, of course. We just talked about the maximum gearing, but they're on this handlebar width thing, and the problem is they're... June 12th from next year, handlebars must be at least 400 millimeters wide. That's 40 centimeters wide at the outer edge with 320 millimeters between the inner edges of the brake levers. An additional memo on June 17th confirmed that the UCI will trial limitations, gear ratios later this year, blah, blah, blah. So why is this a problem with the women? Because the women are smaller than the men. Now, there's a lot of small men that are in the peloton, too, tend to be those big climbers and all. But this is crazy because I have set more women up on bikes with 38-centimeter handlebars. And it fits their shoulders, their shoulder width. Guess what? I ride 40s. I used to ride 42s because I thought I needed 42s. I didn't know what I was doing. Measurement comes back. I'm a 40. That's the smallest that you can put on a UCI regulated bike. That seems oddly wide to me, especially when you're dealing with someone who's maybe somewhere between 5 foot and 5 foot three. They're going to be smaller. They're going to have a smaller rib cage. They're going to have a smaller center to center on their shoulders. UCI, wake up, wake up. Pull up your 6-inch socks and get real, will you please? I said it. Yeah, it's sort of a rant, but you know what? That's what it is, and that's what we got right now, and we're going to move on real quickly because we are starting to get near the end of our show, and so I'm going to go down a few things here. Nope, we're going to pass over that because we already did that earlier. So, Eddie Merckx on Tadej Pogačar's dominance. You want to hear it? Here we go. Eddie Merckx, as the 2025 Tour de France slips into history books, few are better placed to reflect than with Eddie Merckx. Speaking to De Telegraaf, the 80-year-old five-time winner of the Tour offered his take on the race with typical directness, saluting Tadej Pogačar's dominance, raising questions about the depth of his competition. That's interesting. He said nobody showed up to compete with him. That's why. Not going to agree with that, but that's okay. And he said his saving his highest praise for Matthew Vanderpoel. Yeah, Matthew Vanderpoel has got, he is a classic rider. He's really, really strong. Merckx's verdict on the 2025 edition was blunt. The real tension in this Tour de France was never there, he said. Pogačar was never in trouble. He repeated the it for emphasis before turning to the man many still consider his biggest rival. Vinko wasn't a competitor. Over the 3 weeks, he could only do what he could to hold on. Pogačar's fourth yellow jersey puts him one behind Merckx, Anquetil, Hinault, and Indurain. When asked by De Telegraaf, the Slovenian could equal or even surpass the historic five-win mark, Merckx was unequivocal. Absolutely. He doesn't see the achievement in the same light. He is very strong. There is no doubt about that. And we are talking about a different generation, Merckx explained. Pogačar has less competition than I had at my time. That's a bold statement. There was more. If there was more, it would be harder for him to win so much. So Eddie said a lot, but you know what? Eddie's got over 500 wins, and Tadej Pogačar now has a little over 100 wins. You tell me. Merckx owns 525 wins, 11 Grand Tours, 19 monuments. You can't compare to that. And Tadej has got a lot of wins. And Tadej is certainly a lot of fun to watch. But he's nowhere near Eddie Merckx. I rest my argument. I rest my case. I'm moving on. It is time to end the show. And here we go, going into events. I know it's not even August, but we got the Project Mayhem Cyclocross series coming up here in Connecticut. And before you know it, you know, Rocky Hill Cyclocross Training Series will start. So that usually starts in late August and goes into September. Sunday, September 21st, 9th annual Southbridge Credit Union Tour Apakum Bike Ride for Land Conservation. Wow. Yeah, lots of things going on. I'm going to go back to Project Mayhem because I am part of Project Mayhem. Big shout out to Richard Sachs, custom frame builder extraordinaire and bike supporter, bike racing supporter extraordinaire, who is the series main event sponsor. So that's a really cool thing. I'm going to start out on September 6th, Belltown Throwdown in Portland, Connecticut. September 21st, Hidden Valley Cross, New Haven, Connecticut. September 27th, Off the Rails Cross, Portland, Connecticut. 10-7, Newtown Cross, Newtown, Connecticut. 10-11, Damned at the Dam, Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut, right here. That's our race. And the November 16th, Moran Cross in Wallingford, Connecticut. And November 30th, the Orchard Scorcher in Guilford, Connecticut. That's seven races. That's it. Time to finish it up completely here. It's finishing points time. It's the Tour de Femme. Did you watch it? It was great. It was great racing, great women's racing. I think that the racing that really caught my eye this year, this year's women's or the last Olympics that was out there, it really caught my eye because there were things going on that I didn't normally see in women's bike racing. I'm impressed. Keep doing it, ladies. Let's go, man. This is fun. I like this. I know that their attendance level is super high. They've got a pretty good sponsorship going on there right now. It's still nowhere near what the men are doing, but that's the way women's sports work, and hopefully it will get a lot better, as it has somewhat here in the United States. Okay, let's go there. Bicycling is freedom. Life is better for everyone when more people ride bikes. The League of American Bicyclists is making cycling easier and a safer option for more people, because when more people ride, people are happier, healthier, and our communities are safer and friendlier, and our planet is greener. Right. I'm saying it again. It won't be my last time. Get loud. Get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic, dangerous roads, and price of gas, lack of places to safely ride. Do your part. And hey, take the Pedal and Ride Challenge. Consider parking your car or truck for a day and ride your bike instead. You just might surprise yourself. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is Pedal and Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down, the wind at your back, get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. Save mine a few times now. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thanks for listening. Get on your bike,